One way or another, most of us will be making a very significant decision next Tuesday, whether to vote and who to vote for. Well, today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about what is known about what happens in our brains when we make choices and what might be going on when we change our minds or can't make up our minds, like what's going on with all of those undecided voters. We'll address the political side of this discussion in a little while, but first we'll take a look at what neuroscientists can tell us. And joining me now are Dr. Joshua Gold, Assistant Professor of Neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Samuel Wong, Associate Professor of Molecular Biology and Neuroscience at Princeton University. He's the author of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
And the two of you co-authored an op-ed piece that ran in the New York Times earlier this week, which I gather had many journalists calling. So, Josh, can you tell us what that article said and why everyone wanted to know more?
Sure. So, you know, as neuroscientists, Sam and I are always interested in trying to understand what the brain's doing to give rise to sort of interesting behaviors, and we thought it'd be interesting to talk about what we know from neuroscience and psychology about what might be going on literally in the minds of these undecided voters.
We were very,
Go ahead, Sam.
Oh, we were very interested because, of course, in this election campaign, like everyone else, we've been watching very closely, and there's this running joke that's been developing that undecided voters somehow are not paying attention or are not very smart or perhaps are taking forever to gather evidence. And we thought that neuroscience would have something to say to these ideas, which are not, in fact, exactly correct.
Well, the current issue of Harper's reports that researchers, not you, find that 70% of voters who claim to be undecided have already made up their minds. Have you found something similar?
Yeah, so that's actually one of the points that we make in the article. I think the big picture there is that undecided doesn't necessarily mean indifferent. It may just mean uncommitted, and part of that may mean just not explicitly committed. And in fact, there's lots of evidence that people seem to be much more committed to their decisions than they're willing or able to admit.
Sam, let's back up a bit and talk about what's going on when we make a decision. Is the first step simply taking in information?
Well, that's certainly a step in decision-making. In Welcome to Your Brain, we got very interested in this, perhaps conventional ideas that we might have about how we make decisions. You know, if you just ask a guy on the street, how do you make a decision? There might be some common belief like, well, I gather evidence, and then I reach a commitment, and then I've decided. But when people study decision making in the real human brain and look at it from a scientific perspective, it's not a computer like gathering of evidence. So certainly one step of decision is gathering evidence to make a commitment, but there are two other very different processes going on as well. One is becoming aware that you've reached a commitment, and sometimes that doesn't happen until well after you've made your commitment. And another is confidence in your decision. And so the gathering of evidence is certainly part of making a decision, but sometimes it takes a little time for the rest of your brain to know that you've made your commitment.
But doesn't the taking in of the information also then go through the filter of what we are anyway, how we see the world? I've been in situations where, for example, after the debates, some people saw McCain winning strongly, some saw Obama winning strongly. They were the same debates. I suspect that those decisions were based on how those people saw the whole political process, what they were looking for and what they didn't want to even think about.
I think that's right. I think that there's a phenomenon that psychologists have studied called biased assimilation. Another is called motivated reasoning. And these refer to the fact that no information ever comes in a vacuum. You always have assumptions about how the world works, shortcuts that you take that have gotten you out of a jam in the past. And when you watch these debates, you have prior beliefs. Your prior belief might be that John McCain's an upstanding guy. Your prior belief might be that Obama is the kind of guy who can bring people together and bring about the kind of change that's necessary now. When you have these beliefs, You watch everything through that filter, and there's a tendency among everyone, and I mean everyone, to tend to accept information that fits with what they already believe prior to seeing the debate, and to reject evidence that perhaps doesn't agree with their preconceptions.
What happens when you look at the way the brain is making decisions through an fMRI?
Yeah, well, so that's one of the another of the interesting points that we make in the article. fMRI is a way, of course, of imaging activity in the brain of people while they're doing interesting things like thinking about the election or watching a video screen, and it's certainly proven to be incredibly useful at identifying where in the brain there is activity of nerve cells that might be useful for the kinds of things that the person is doing. One of the points we make in the article is that despite the incredible advances that have been made with fMRI to understand basic principles of brain function, it still hasn't allowed us to do the kinds of things that I think a lot of people would like to be able to do with it, particularly in the context of an election, which is, well, why can't you just scan the brains of undecided voters and see what it is that they're thinking? And even if they're not able or willing to describe their commitment, maybe their brain is. And it turns out that that's still just a little bit beyond our capabilities. And I think the fundamental problem there is that the high-level concepts that go into making a decision about an election, we simply don't understand them well enough to be able to map them to specific parts of the brain.
Well, since it sounds like most people don't really change their minds, do we know what happens when to the people who do? Are they approaching it with a different situation, or are they people who don't have the kind of firm, in the case of voting, firm political commitment that would lead me to view a candidate one way and somebody else to view the candidate totally differently?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of ways of looking at it. One is that their commitment point might just be different than other people. In other words, they might have as much evidence and as much confidence as anyone else, but there's something about their brains that causes them to require more confidence to actually make that final commitment. And one of the points we made is that in terms of an election, there's actually something sort of optimal about not committing until you're actually in the voting booth, because that's really the only time that you need to show the commitment.
Josh, you wanted to add something?
Oh, that was Josh. So let's see. So
yeah, Sam.
Sorry, this is Sam here.
People confuse us all the time.
We're not alike at all, really. But this gets back to issues having to do with awareness. And so when you look at polling numbers, the number of undecided voters doesn't seem to change very quickly. And if you look at focus groups, they don't seem to change very quickly. Yet, at the same time, swings in the campaign can happen quite sharply from week to week after some big event like a debate. And one possibility is that many undecided voters are, in fact, not very different from decided voters. They might be as committed as the rest of us, but they're just not aware of it yet. So, for instance, in our article in the Times, we referred to a study of uncommitted voters in Italy who were about to vote on a controversial U.S. military base expansion. And they thought they were undecided. But then what psychologists did was give them a quick word association task where they showed them pictures of the military base and then tested how quickly they could associate them with positive or negative words. And what they found was that the automatic reactions of those people were very predictive of what they were going to decide a week later. And so they thought that they were undecided, yet there were commitments that they had already made in their brains to some decision or another, even though they were not able to state them.
Didn't one study reveal that people who startle more easily are more likely to be more conservative in their voting patterns? I don't see how that connects, but I just read that.
Yeah, there are a lot of studies like that where people attempt to connect personality traits with political affiliations, and I think that without criticizing them in a blanket sort of way, it should be pointed out that people who conduct academic studies on the psychology of politics are almost always coming at it from a liberal direction. That is, that their own leanings are liberal. That doesn't mean that their findings are false, but it means that there's a demographic of people who study these things, and they're not conservatives. Now, there are things that correlate with being liberal or conservative. So, for instance, it's been found that people who report being Republicans are often much more concerned about things like local community building. And so there do seem to be personality traits that correlate with political leanings. But I think that evidence for, you know, basic wiring being different from individual to individual being predictive of politics, like startle reflexes, I think that one would have to take that sort of thing with a grain of salt.
My guests are Dr. Joshua Gold, Assistant Professor of Neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Samuel Wong, Associate Professor of Molecular Biology and Neuroscience at Princeton University. We are talking about why some people are undecided at this late date from a scientific point of view. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope. We got a comment on a comment line from Linda from Fairfield County. She writes that she was shocked to find out that her husband is still undecided. He runs a large company with many employees around the country, so he's trying to calculate which candidate's policies would better serve his employees, and he thinks McCain's policies would make it easier for his company to be profitable, while Obama's plan would be better for the employees themselves. And he, since he has these people's jobs in his hands, he's still not sure who he wants to vote for.
Yeah, I saw that story, and I think it speaks very directly to one of the things that we're learning about the neuroscience of decision making, which is one of the most difficult things that the brain has to do when making decisions is weigh information that may not be obvious how to weigh it or how to compare different pieces of information. You know, how do you compare the fact that one policy might be in line with the way you feel about the economy, while something else might be more in line with how you feel about foreign policy, and how do you combine those two pieces of information in a meaningful way? And I think that's one of the things that gets in the way of commitment for a lot of people, that they simply just they don't know which piece of evidence to pay more attention to.
I should say that in addition to that, that one thing that's interesting here is that people are often of the belief that they are not committed, and perhaps this fellow thinks he's not committed, but one thing that's been observed is that people who are close to people who call themselves undecided are often aware of that person's commitment before they are. So perhaps I wonder whether this woman is already aware of some glimmering of a decision in her husband's mind, even though he himself may not be aware of it yet.
So Linda may know how he's going to vote, even if he's not sure.
I bet on it.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Carol Daugherty from the Pew Research Center for People and the Press, and he'll join the conversation. And then we will be taking your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. Don't go away. And we're back with Please Explain and our two neuroscientists, Drs. Joshua Gold and Sam Wong. And we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692, talking about undecided voters. And we are welcoming now Carol Daugherty. Thank you so much for being with us. We've been talking about the science behind making decisions. Can you tell us about what's known about voters in this election? First,
well,
the undecided voters from your polling.
Right. We have 8% in our most recent poll who say they're undecided. These are people who say they don't know, either decline to state a preference or say they don't know. And
is 8%,
we know something about them. They're mostly women, less educated, and less engaged in the election.
Now, is 8% typical at this point in a presidential election?
It's typical. It went down to 6% in our final poll of 2004. It probably will tick down a couple of points when we come out on Sunday. It's 5% in Gallup's poll. I expect it probably will narrow a little bit in the days remaining.
And you say it's mostly uneducated women,
or less educated women. So we did a profile of them in our recent survey. 63% are women. About half have only a high school education versus 40% of all voters. They live throughout the country. They're not disproportionately located in the swing states. Some people ask us that, or undecided voters in undecided states. They're not. And otherwise, I think they look pretty much like the rest of the electorate.
But it sounds to me like they're uninterested rather than undecided.
Well, I think you have two groups of undecided voters. By and large, if you look at them as a whole, they are less engaged in the election, and this is a very high engagement election. People are really paying attention in far higher numbers than in previous elections. But undecided voters are not. 37% are following election news very closely, compared to more than half of McCain and Obama supporters. But I think those that are focusing on the election are being cross-pressured. I think the story in the final days is that most of these people, like most voters generally, are very unhappy with national conditions. They're unaffiliated politically for the most part, so they have no Republican allegiance. But they're not quite ready to vote for Obama yet. They may have doubts about his experience or preparedness. And so, you know, they're kind of conflicted. These are the cross-pressured voters.
Well, we heard today that the infomercial that Barack Obama ran on Wednesday had incredibly high ratings. Do you think, I'm throwing this out to all of you, do you think that those viewers were people who were still undecided? Are they more likely to be Obama supporters who just wanted to feel good about their candidate?
Well, I would say that it's, given the cross section, given the large number we saw in the ratings, I would suspect that it would include all of the above. Probably not too many committed McCain supporters, but I suspect there are some undecideds who are making a last check, as well as some committed Obama supporters.
And when you, I ask the neuroscientists, when you look at people who are at this point of decision making, do you see any difference than if they had made the decision 2 months ago or 3 months ago?
Well, let's see. So what I'd like to do is come back to this idea that that I think we've just heard about undecided voters in some sense being not yet committed. And I think this comes to a collision between polling science and neuroscience. So we call undecided voters people who haven't made up their minds and perhaps are uncommitted. But the entire point of our editorial and of a lot of neuroscience is that, in fact, people may already be committed. And so it may be a mistake to think of undecided voters as being any different from decided voters, but in some sense what they really are is people who don't have immediate access to what's going on. And so I have a question for the pollster. Carol, I wonder whether, I know that pollsters often ask questions like, who do you think understands your problems better? Mm-hmm. Are you more concerned about the economy or terrorism? And I wonder whether these questions could be used to probe these undecided voters to find out whether they have hidden biases that can predict which way they'll fall.
It's very difficult to do that. I mean, on some issues, what we found consistently is that on some issues, they do look a little Republican. For instance, in past surveys, not this most recent one, but in past surveys, we found that they support McCain on terrorism. They believe he could defend the country better. Yet they feel stressed economically, and they support Obama on the economy. They worry about Obama's leadership, but they certainly don't want four more years of the current administration. So you see conflicts throughout the line. The problem is that you don't know which of these positions or feelings is going to tip the balance in their own mind, or already has if they've already made up their mind.
Well, one observation that's been made in psychology studies of decision making is that when people are only moderately sure, even if they're only a little bit sure of a decision they're going to be make, they are very strongly prone to making that decision eventually. And so I know that, for instance, pollsters often like to push to see which way people are leaning. And one thing that's interesting from behavioral research is that those leanings are often very predictive of how people are eventually going to vote. So even a weak leaning, I think, might be predictive.
You know, what's striking in our poll analysis of the undecideds was we tried to push, and we got 49% saying they still didn't know. Come on, you know, could you possibly vote for either one of these two men? 49% don't know. 29% say they'd vote for either, so they're still unsure. They're moving back and forth. 7% say they might vote for McCain but not vote for Obama, and 7%, the exact same percentage, say they might vote for Obama and not McCain.
Well,
and we look at that data and say, well, it looks as if they're going to split pretty evenly if you had to guess.
That's quite possible. So, but again, I wonder whether they you have to trick them a little bit, because, in fact, they may not be aware of their biases, but if you could find ways to sneak around these direct questions.
Well, right. How much of this is based on other kinds of biases, you know, like we just respond well to somebody who is tall and thin as opposed to short and fat. You know, there's sometimes they say short politicians don't do as well at the polls. The way somebody dresses, the color of their hair, in this campaign, of course, is also the race issue. But these things may not always be things that we're totally conscious of.
Yeah, and another related point is that one thing that we certainly understand from the neuroscience of decision making is that it isn't just a full speed ahead process that sort of ends up in one place. That it probably depends a lot on when you ask, and that, you know, we know that people who say they're undecided now say they're decided later, and the opposite, people say that they're decided now become undecided later. So it's a very fluid process, and all of these variables are going to need to take into account.
We're inviting calls at 212-433-9692. We did get a message from Dennis from Greenpoint, who writes, "I'm undecided between Nader and Obama. I voted for Nader twice before, but I can't imagine McCain in office. It's obvious Nader would never win, but the issues being addressed is what really concerns him, and he's not sure that Obama will really offer all that much change."
I'm under the impression that 4 years ago, people like him usually ended up voting for the Democratic candidate.
Well, I suspect that will occur again this year, especially Democrats with memories of 2000. Certainly, we see Nader at most 1% in our latest poll.
If you have an opinion about being undecided or you're undecided yourself, we do invite your calls at 212-433-9692. My guests are Dr. Joshua Gold, Assistant Professor of Neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Samuel Wong, Associate Professor of Molecular Biology and Neuroscience at Princeton University, and Carol Doherty of the Pew Research Center. And we go now to Natalie from Brooklyn. Hi, Natalie, you're on the air.
I just wanted to pose this question. I have a feeling that people are innately, many people, especially people who tend towards being cautious and conservative, many people are simply afraid of change. They'd rather live with a status quo that they don't like than actually pull the lever for something that would mean change. Do you think that's true?
I think that's reflected in our surveys again with these people who are still undecided at this late stage in the election, yet are very dissatisfied with what they see in the country today. They're just not quite willing yet to pull the lever for Obama for whatever reason.
But aren't they inherent? Isn't that more true of people who tend to be conservative?
Well, I mean, most of the people who are undecided, they don't have a basis. They're not strong ideologically either way. Most of them are unaffiliated. They call themselves moderate, but I think they're kind of not very ideological in either direction.
What about you, Sam and Josh?
Yeah, there is some correspondence between novelty seeking and wanting new experiences and being politically liberal. And so I think it's a weak correspondence. I wouldn't say it's generally true of everyone. I certainly know conservatives who like new experiences. But there is a tendency for those traits to be correlated with one another.
Let's take another call. Barbara from Montclair, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This isn't exactly about undecided voters, but it's about a segment of voters that I seem to be bumping into a lot. And I am just reading a book called What's the Matter with Kansas?
Where he is
talking about a type of voter who makes decisions not on a logical basis at all, which is frequently what I hear in terms of people talking about pollsters, as if everyone is actually looking at the financial plan. And this book was more about people who are jumping to conclusions. And I was wondering if the neuroscientists had done any study. That seems like a totally different concept of thinking. I think of as thinking, and I was wondering if the neuroscientists had looked into that at all.
I think that's a great question, and it speaks to something deep about how we make decisions. So, naively, I think the author of that book, Thomas Frank, has made an important point that's becoming well understood by neuroscientists, which is that emotions, in fact, play a deep and central role in how we make decisions. And in fact, emotions are what give our decisions valence. We make our decisions about what we reach judgments about what's important or unimportant based on emotions. And without emotions, it's very hard to make a good decision. So, for instance, in people who have brain damage in brain regions that are important for connecting unspoken intuitions with actions, people with damage to those brain regions often take inordinate amount of time to make decisions, and sometimes, in fact, have trouble doing things like picking shirts in the morning. And so, in fact, I think there's a very central role for emotions, and what reason often does is fill in the reasons afterwards. And so what we do is engage in motivated reasoning. In Welcome to Your Brain, we write about this process of reaching a gut decision and then filling in reasons that account for the decision we've already made.
Thank you so much for your call. Julie from New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Actually, I just wanted to comment on the email that you had read earlier about the individual who is on the fence about Nader or Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something, actually, that I related to. As I said to your screener when I called, I certainly wouldn't vote Republican. I'm a registered independent, as I said. But I find myself, the whole spin thing and everything, every time something comes up when it comes to the news or they're reporting something, I always am looking for the hook, getting us to believe something that isn't necessarily true. So I guess if that factors into making decisions, that's how I make my decisions. I'm always looking for the hook.
Well, and Julie, so, did you watch the debates?
All of them.
And did they have any impact on your decision making?
I can relate to, and I guess this goes to, I'm educated. I have a college degree. I don't know whether that factors in, but I can relate more to the Democratic approach than Republican. I find it very difficult to relate to John McCain.
So you were watching those debates with a slight tilt toward anything that Barack Obama said.
I gave John McCain. I do absolutely respect the man's service to the country. There's just no doubt in my mind that that is absolutely an amazing thing that he did, and I respect that.
Let me bring this to Carol Daugherty. Do the polls indicate that people are influenced by what they saw, what they see in the debates?
I think that was one of the factors that enabled Obama to kind of hold the lead he has for the past several weeks. I think the other factor, there were a couple of other factors, but I think the debates were very important. I think you can see that as something of a turning point in this election.
Well, Julie talked about the spin, and after the debates, we would watch on all the different channels, we would watch people do spin. Often the spin turned out to be totally different from what the polls wound up indicating. I remember seeing CNN and seeing William Bennett say that, oh, McCain won this debate really big. And then in came the polls, the early polls, and they indicated that the public had felt Obama had won it big.
That's right. And more fundamentally, it changed the patterns in the presidential horse race. I mean, he went from about even to holding a 6-7 point lead after the debate.
Is there a big difference between the decision to run away from a tiger and deciding who to vote for? The running away, of course, is self-preservation. But we actually have to think, okay, I'm going to run over here and try to get away by climbing over that fence. Is that all that different, ultimately, when we look at the brains?
Yeah,
well, first
that's a very good question, and that's really kind of the essence of our work. We think that there are commonalities. I mean, obviously there are big differences, but I think one of the points that you were sort of getting at is that that there might be something deliberative even about the decision to run away from the tiger. You know, exactly how do you do it? Where do you go? And it's that process of deliberation that we think that at least to some degree might share some of the same mechanisms as the deliberative decision making you have to do for the election.
There were others who wanted to add to that.
Oh, yes. I wanted to get back to, in fact, to pundit reactions to the debate. One thing that's very interesting, getting back to this issue of biased assimilation, is that pundits themselves seem to be not very good at reaching some kind of reasoned judgment about what happens, because they seem to bring their own biases to the table. And so, for instance, in the case of watching the debates, I observed in watching those debates that if I watched simple behavioral signs like physical mannerisms and so on of the candidates, I was able to reach a rough estimate of how undecided voters or uncommitted voters react. But television pundits seem to be very bad at this. And one thing that's interesting is that expertise is not always good for reasoned judgments. One example of this that takes an extreme is people with obsessive-compulsive disorder who spend a lot of time evaluating evidence in a very reasoned kind of way. And people who with OCD often are very bad at making decisions from the gut. And so one possibility with pundits is they perhaps are too expert and are a little bit unable to evaluate evidence in some kind of unbiased fashion.
I've always felt a few of them reminded me of OCD people. But what I was getting at also with the tiger is that the decisions are made very fast in our brains. And I wonder whether those decisions are made fast in these kinds of areas as well, and whether people who are undecided are undecided for other reasons.
Yeah, I mean, the real answer to that is we don't know. Looking at even the fastest decisions, and when I'm talking fast, even less than a second, things that take on the order of a couple hundred milliseconds that you're not even remotely aware of them happening, seem to involve the same sort of deliberative evidence gathering process as the longer decisions. And so that really is the essence of why we think that studying simple decisions might actually tell us something about how the brain works on more complex decisions.
Thank you all so much for participating in today's Please Explain, and I hope that we've helped our listeners make up their minds finally. Dr. Joshua Gold is Assistant Professor of Neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Samuel Wong, Associate Professor of Molecular Biology and Neuroscience at Princeton University. And Carol Doherty is with the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.